is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted today to be talking to Dan Sandin, a pioneer in many of the contemporary art forms, including video art, digital arts, computer arts. Dan, maybe you can present yourself.
Hi, I'm Dan Sandin, and I've been working in the area of kind of art cross science, digital computation, and analog computation since the mid-60s. So I thought I would talk a little bit. One of the things that was happening during that period in the 60s and the 70s was really a transition from analog computation to digital computation. And I worked in both of those areas. And I think there's some lessons from those areas, and there's things you can do in analog computation that were very hard to do in digital computation. So I thought I'd start talking about that.
Excellent. And, my own training was originally as a physicist, so I learned circuit design right at the beginning. And so I've lived through that transition also. So why don't you develop that further?
So I'll probably start in like 1969. In 1969, I came to the University of Illinois at Chicago, then called Chicago Circle. And I was actually invited by the art department to bring computers and cybernetic activities into the art department. And that's actually quite extraordinary, because even as little as a decade ago, art departments are still struggling with the idea of whether they should bring this kind of technology into routine use, especially in their introductory courses. And so when I got there,
just as a side question. So who was the instigator of that in the art department? Who was it that invited you?
It was really a group of people. That art department is really arguably the second generation or third generation Bauhaus. And of course, one oversimplification of the Bauhaus is they took kind of, craft activities and industrial production technology and invented industrial design. I mean, that's one of their major threads. And there are two places that could be thought of being the second generation Bauhaus. One is IIT in Chicago, the Institute of Design. Yeah. And the other would be the Center for Advanced Visual Studies.
Yeah, the George Kepesh set up.
Right. So, and the university I was at was one of these instant urban universities developed in the 60s, and they drawed heavily on the faculty of the Institute of Design to set up their program. Uh-huh. So that was kind of the background. So their idea was to combine essentially computers or cybernetic activities. A cybernetic age was one of the jargon terms of the time, with industrial design to produce a new synthesis.
Uh-huh.
And so that was the kind of intellectual justification for them being interested in this. And
So you got there in 1969, you were saying?
Yeah. Right. During that time period, I did work with computer systems. Before that, at the University of Wisconsin, in particular, some very advanced computer systems that weren't punch card bashed oriented things, and they were called laboratory instrument computers. One of them was the Link 8, and it was like a modern personal computer, except that it was in a 19-inch rack 6 feet high. Uh-huh. Had real-time text on-screen text editing, was designed to essentially monitor and control scientific experiments, so it had all this analog I.O. in it, and was designed for real-time operation, which kind of informed me about those possibilities.
Just for interest, what was your original training in?
Physics. I have a master's degree in nuclear physics from the University of Wisconsin, was working towards a PhD, and then kind of found out that I really was much more interested in kind of image making and photography and using projection technology and light show kinds of ideas. When I was in idle time, that was what I was thinking about. So yeah. I decided I should.
I mean,
try
it's,
to change.
It's interesting that the art department had no trouble hiring a physicist at that point. There's a lot of current discussion about, as you know, interdisciplinarity and whether what kinds of people art departments should be hiring. So it's interesting that already in the mid '60s, this was really you know, in that group at least, it was totally received wisdom to hire people from very different disciplines.
Yeah, that, and I don't think I'm not. I don't think that would actually be possible in the in that art department now. I mean, it isn't that they're kind of have an adjunct relationship or a shared position or something like that. I was like a instructor in the art department, and then you know further on in the assistant professor, et cetera.
Yeah, by coincidence, I have a joint appointment in the Department of Physics and the School of Art and Technology. So I have a double appointment. So it is possible, but it is difficult, as you point out. So maybe we can just get back to it. So when you get this whole issue that you sort of started sounding out about and building some history to was this transition between the analog and the digital. You want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, there were the audience may not be aware of this, but there was a period where computation used in, let's say, the simulation of airplanes and things like that was analog. And I was later than the mechanical analog computers, but the electronic analog computers where you have circuits that can add and multiply and do kind of functional lookups and actually run computations. And they, you know, they actually were much faster than the digital computers of the time. And one of the examples of that I was involved in is in the, after I got to the University of Illinois at Chicago, I developed a video synthesizer called the Sandine Analog Image Processor. It was essentially routing a bunch of video signals through a structure, which was very much like a general purpose analog computer, except that it had special circuits for handling synchronization and other things, where you would add images together, which produces superimposition, and multiply images, which produces keys, and then various kinds of what would now be done as table lookups, which were analog circuits that could kind of act like the sliders in a modern image processing program like Photoshop, except they were real-time. And with live video signals moving through it. So at that time, which was kind of contemporary with the Cray 1 the first Cray 1 did 80 megaflops per second. And of course now, you know, the phone probably does a gigaflop in your pocket. So, but the analog image processor had 5 megahertz bandwidth, standard video bandwidth, and so it could, you know, handle, you know, say 2.5 megaflops per second. They were actually only 8-bit. Floating point operations, but you would have, you know, the IP had like 24 modules, and it was very common to run 20 or 30 circuit paths through it. So you multiply that out, and it becomes much faster than the Cray 1. Now the flops were a lot floppier. I mean, the signal noise ratio, the number of bits in a word, was much smaller, but the computational speed was higher. And because it essentially has to do everything in real time, these kind of circuits really have no way to store video signals. It meant that everything you did was live and in kind of a performance mode, like musical performance. And that very strongly influenced the my video artwork in the 70s. Those machines are actually still in use. At the School of the Art Institute, they actually teach the Sandine Analog Image Processor as part of their live video production operation, and people use them to do essentially the equivalent of light shows for rock bands. The reason really is the interface. I mean, the modern artists working in this field certainly know about digital computers and know about PDGEM and all that kind of thing, but they choose to use these analog instruments. And so there's something about the way you interact, something about the interface of it, that's not been well captured by the modern digital interfaces.
Yeah, and as you point out, in that transition to the digital, obviously it was driven by very different kinds of professionals and their needs. And so some things which are easier to do in analog electronics became quite difficult to do in software systems, and so as you say, especially in these performance contexts, we're almost seeing a return to the analog in some cases.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a large community of performing video artists who use analog instruments. Usually, it's hybrid; they also use digital instruments at the same time. But that the heart of it really is they use digital instruments, especially for image sources. and for image recording and things like the equivalent of video loops, but the actual control and mixing is analog.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that happened in that transition is that the way that sound and image are handled in software often are quite separate strategies and systems, whereas analog systems, you can obviously mix and remix in much more direct kind of ways sound signals and visual signals. And so the digital actually divorces some of the technologies of sound from some of the technologies of vision.
So computers are powerful enough now to do both at once and to integrate the two, but I don't think the human control mechanisms, the interface, has been invented yet that supersedes the natural interfaces that come with the analog instruments. So another way to think about the analog image processor that I developed in the late 90s and early 70s, late 60s and early 70s, was that it was essentially the video equivalent of a Moog Model 2 audio synthesizer, because I had a bunch of choices about whether I did patch programming or cable programming or a matrix, pin matrix programming, and I decided to go with a very much in parallel to the Moog Model 2. And the IP had circuits for converting between the standards of the Moog Model 2 and the analog image processor, so you could actually connect those things together in performance.
Dan, we have a few minutes left on this particular podcast. Why don't you just begin maybe the comment that you made to me earlier, which obviously it's later than the digital to analog transition, but the disruptive nature of video technology at the time, maybe you can just say a few words about that.
Of course, in the 70s, the video technology was entirely analog, and only a little bit of digital stuff was creeping in the early 70s and what have you. But it was very much like the internet revolution of, let's say, the 90s, where if you imagine TV before the Portapak and before small video cameras, it was still the dominant communication medium of the culture, but entirely in the control of TV stations and corporations. Yep. And there was really no way to get independent views in that weren't filtered through this mechanism. But the invention of the Portapak the ability to essentially connect that up directly to cable TV systems, which were available there. I mean, we don't think of Comcast as kind of a utopian grassroots operation, but they began as kind of community antenna systems and cable systems in communities that would have a centralized big antenna and then essentially, but using cable, rebroadcast the TV signals to people's houses. And they were very much kind of grassroots and utopian motivation. And all of that got together essentially to put in the hands of individuals for the cost of a used car, the ability to actually communicate with the dominant communication.
So the disruptive nature was not only the technical one in terms of ease of use and the kind of things you could do with the handheld video, but obviously the social adoption, which, as you say, changed the whole distribution system and production system, and then actually created within our community, at least, a whole reservoir of people who were very early adopters of the internet for very similar reasons.
Right, with very much the same kind of utopian goals and beliefs that it would transform society, and it did.
Yeah. Okay, Dan, we're going to have to wrap up this initial podcast, but I look forward to continuing the discussion in the next one. And I encourage our listeners to click over to the second episode. Thank you.